hot outside. Protests happen when it's hot outside. Rebellions and revolutions happen when it's hot outside. People are hot. They're short-tempered, angry, impatient, uncomfortable, and demanding. In this week's Torah portion, we read about a rebellion against Moses. Oh, it was very hot there. The Israelites were in the middle of the desert. They had just been condemned to another 38 years of wandering in this wilderness, and they were going to die there. That set off the most serious rebellion against Moses' leadership, led by a man named Korach. Korach was not of the masses. He was of the elite. Anarchists generally do not lead revolutions. Revolutions are serious endeavors by serious people. They are led by the political, financial, and intellectual elites. Syrian President Assad won't fall until the elites rebel against him. It was the generals who finally told Hosni Mubarak it was time to go. Korach was the very definition of the elite. He was the first cousin to Moses and Aaron, and he didn't rise up alone. He rebelled, as the Torah tells us, with 250 leaders of the community. The Bible specifies prominent people of influence and of high reputation. Some revolutions are good. Others are not good. We consider the American Revolution to be just, and we consider the Bolshevik Revolution to be unjust. In Judaism, too, some revolutions are good, as in the liberation of the slaves from Egypt. Other revolutions are not good, as in the rebellion of Korach against Moses, which you will be relieved to know was put down forcefully and effectively. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here. How do we assess the justice of a revolution? How do we tell the difference between a good revolution and a bad one? It's a relevant question today in our era of revolutions. There's a fascinating passage in the Talmud that addresses this question. We read in our parasha that one of the men that Korach mobilized for the rebellion was a man named On, the son of Pelet, from the tribe of Reuben. We have no idea who is this On, the son of Pelet. He is never again mentioned in the Bible. We read his name only here in passing, almost in parentheses, in the context of Korach mobilizing him for rebellion. But we don't read what happened to him. Did he die with the rebels, or was he saved? He disappears from the Bible after this one mention of him. So, of course, Talmudic rabbis were intrigued by this. Why was he mentioned at all? If it is only here and in passing, what did the Bible want to teach us by mentioning the name of On, the son of Pelet, but never telling us anything else about him? And did he die there in the rebellion, or was he somehow saved? The sages answer the mystery in the following way. Rav said, On was saved by his wife. Now, mind you, On's wife is never even mentioned at all anywhere in the Bible. It is simply assumed that On has a wife. In the Talmud, the rabbis envision her saying to her husband, "What does it matter to you if Moses prevails or if Korach prevails? Either way, one of them will be the master, and you will continue to be the disciple." And On responded to his wife, "What can I do? I have already sworn allegiance to the rebels." In other words, he said, "Oy vey, you're right. What have I done?"
She said to him, "Sit down here, and I will save you." So she served him wine, and he drank, and he drank, and he became inebriated. And she laid him down in his bed to sleep. Then she sat at the entrance to the tent and loosened her hair. To loosen your hair must have been some sexually suggestive gesture in antiquity, sort of like hanging a do not disturb sign on the bedroom door. In any case, when Korach's men came by to summon On, they retreated at the sight of his wife with her loosened hair at the entrance to the tent. They went on to rebel without him and to die, while On lay in his bed, in his tent, drunk out of his mind, saved by his wife. Traditionally, this passage has been interpreted to praise the unique and superior insight of women. Women know better than men about human nature, some argue. They restrain the intemperate passions of men. Anyone who follows the HBO series Game of Thrones knows this to be true, they would say. They are shrewder and more sophisticated than men. They are better at verbal expression and social interaction. Perhaps. I don't want to go there. There's nothing in it for me to go there. The key for me is that On's wife knew her husband. She knew the heart of the man that she knew best. He was a foot soldier in the rebellion. He wasn't a leader. That's why he was mentioned only once, to telegraph to us that he was one of the masses. Not very important. He was manipulated by Korach, drafted by him to further Korach's objectives. And On's wife zeroed in on what made her husband tick. His yearning to improve his lot and perhaps gain a little more prestige, a little more recognition, a little more understanding from society. This is what everyone wants. Many of us can be drafted into the revolution with the promise of improving our lives and gaining an additional modest measure of respect from other people. Either way, she said, you're screwed. It's not going to happen. Either way, if it be Moses or if it be Korach, they will be the boss and you will be the underling. Your life won't change, so why risk it? For nothing? All of these politicians are the same, she argues. They are in it for themselves, not for the people. Now, whether she actually believed that there was no difference between Moses and Korach, at least in terms of her husband's interests, we don't know. I would like to think that she still supported the Moses revolution of freedom and self-determination in the Promised Land. But she tells her husband what she knows will move him. She says nothing about politics or revolutionary theory. She simply reminds him, your life is not going to change one way or the other, so why follow the rebels? She focuses on his self-interest. And she convinced him with that one sentence. At least she convinced him to allow her to make him drunk. The Talmud then goes on to describe Korach's wife in contrast to what she said to her husband. Korach's wife egged her husband on, according to the Talmud. She said to him, see what Moses has done? He has become king and makes sport of you as though you were dirt. He makes you, my husband Korach, look foolish. Korach's wife, too, knew the heart of the person she knew best. She knew how to prompt Korach into action. She zeroed in on what made him tick. It is what makes many politicians and would-be revolutionaries tick. his easy-to-bruise ego, his pride, his yearning for regard, leadership, adulation, power, and control. She, too, didn't talk about freedom, ostensibly the whole point of the Exodus. She didn't speak politics to the politician. There was no masterclass on John Locke, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, or John Stuart Mill. She spoke about what she knew her husband cared about most. "He's made you look like a fool, like dirt," she says. She knew his real motivations. Everyone can talk highfalutin rhetoric. The revolution is about human rights. The revolution is about democracy. The revolution is about freedom. Korach himself accused Moses of treason using the following language. Listen to this. Listen what he says to Moses. Ki he'eltanu me'eretz zavat chalav u'devash laham mitenu b'midbar. You, Moses, have taken us out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? What he meant by "you took us out of a land flowing with milk and honey" was Egypt, not Israel. He called Egypt a land flowing with milk and honey. This is how you know that the Torah considers his rebellion to be illegitimate. See how politicians use and misuse language? Korach spoke of a land flowing with milk and honey, and what he meant was Egypt, not Israel. Mubarak spoke about Egyptian democracy, and what he meant was to suppress Egyptian democracy. China speaks about human rights, and what they mean is to suppress human rights. Hamas speaks about martyrdom, and what they mean is indiscriminate killing. Political language is often used to make lies sound truthful and to purify that which is corrupt. As Jeremiah proclaims, "All is well. All is well," say the leaders, "when nothing is well." They have acted shamefully, yet they do not feel shame. They cannot be made to blush, says Jeremiah. Summer is gone, but we have not been saved. Everyone has personal motivations. This is human nature. It is the nature of politics to be driven by personal needs as well, and many politicians seem to have unusually powerful personal needs. There's nothing necessarily unusual or even wrong with this. And even if there is, it can't be changed. But the justice of the revolution is determined by its predominant motivation. Are the leaders motivated by the welfare of the people? Do they care more about the people's needs than their own needs? It has to be about more than power and the prestige of the position and the mechanical fulfillment of the job responsibilities. As we approach the day that we mark our own American Revolution, in the end, the revolution has to be of the people, by the people, and for the people, with liberty and justice for all.